wake up the tape person. And I need to introduce myself for sake of you who came today and for the tape. I'm Margaret Wold, more commonly known sometimes as Marge, and I am currently a staff member with the Division for Service and Mission in America of the American Lutheran Church. And I'm assigned to the six states of our South Pacific District to work with congregations in changing communities. So I've been given the title Director for Ministry in Changing Communities, which means I work with about 80 congregations in those six states, that have been impacted by change in the neighborhoods around the church. That change can be economic, lifestyle, from single family to apartment dwellings, or racial, age, whatever. But the congregation usually is in a state of decline due to change. So, and then my other hat, I guess, that I wear here is as president of the board of directors of Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, which is an LCA-owned seminary, but in which the ALC and the AELC cooperate in the training of pastors. And ALC students represent about half of the student body. My general theme this week will be under kind of an ambiguous title, A View from the Water's Edge. And I took that title, for several reasons, but mainly because I wanted to say that whatever I say this week is from my particular perspective. You know, I'm not going to generalize, and nobody else has to say, oh, that's exactly what happened to me, because we all speak out of our own particularity. And I don't like people who make great generalizations out of their experience, and I'm sure you wouldn't care to have me do that. So everything that I say is open to challenge, open to debate, open to dialogue. I'm not making any absolute statements or anything. And so my talks this week will be simply a view from my perspective, and I call it a view from the water's edge, because we live on the edge of the Pacific, and some significant things have happened to us there. So generally, under that ambiguous theme, I'll be dealing with change, since that's what I work with all the time, the impact of change on people, what changes are going on, what change does to people and groups, and its effects, its dynamics, how we cope with it, how we deal with change, and some of the things that I think are going to change. I'll step out into the unknown and maybe make a few predictions as I go along. But I'm also going to be this week, since I have tonight and tomorrow night, and then I have two morning sessions on Thursday and Friday, kind of start out with personal change. And so I've chosen the theme, A Day in the Life of a Smiling Woman. And as I look around, I see mostly women here. Well, it's too bad. I see a few men are here to defend their point of view and kind of speak for themselves, and that's good. The others ought to be here too. But we'll just go on with that. And then tomorrow night, we'll be talking about change as it affects our interpersonal relationships. I would have liked to have started with that tonight, because today is a particular day in our life. It's the 9th anniversary of the day we had a happening at the water's edge of the Pacific when Erling broke his neck in a body surfing accident and was totally paralyzed. And we hauled him out of the water paralyzed. And I've been asked also to mention our books, since the bookstore doesn't want to have them left here at the end of the summer. And they've got a supply there. And so we have this book, What Do I Have to Do? Break My Neck, which is the story of that time, 9 years ago today. And Thanks for the Mountain, a follow-up book on the depression that we experienced afterwards and what we thought that meant in our lives. And Who's Running Your Life, which is an answer to the question people asked us after this accident, was it God's will that Erling should break his neck? And so we try to answer that. And then we have written together one that has the exciting title of Bible Readings for Couples. Well, Augsburg Publishing House chose the title. We didn't, so we had another one in mind. And then the two books that I've written myself called The Shalom Woman and The Critical Moment, which has mainly to do with crises in women's life, came out of my experience when I was marriage, family, and child counseling and doing quite a bit of crisis counseling. So that's it, and I think that takes care of, well, I didn't say then what I'll be speaking about. Tomorrow night, relational, what change does to our relationships. And then Thursday and Friday, kind of branching out, looking at some global changes and some neighborhood changes and their impact on people, groups, and congregations especially. So tonight, we're going to be, I'd like you, as I read this story, and it's just part of a story, it's not the whole story, but just the introduction, I'd like to have you, as I read it, try to ask yourself as I go along, how does this make me feel? You know, what am I feeling now? And try to record that feeling. You might, if you have paper and pencil, you might even want to jot down anger, you know, fear, disgust, joy, freedom, whatever your feelings are. And I think that's very important because having worked with Lutherans a lot of years in groups and as individuals, I think it is very hard for us to get in touch with our feelings. We value, as Lutheran people, you know, the fact that we're rational people. We don't jump around like the holy rollers. We don't yell amen and praise the Lord and in church. And, you know, we're people who are, we've got it all together. And we're people who have it in our heads. And recently, in fact, last January, I was asked to be the retreat leader at a spiritual renewal retreat for pastors in part of our district. And we came together at a Franciscan renewal center north of Phoenix, Arizona. And the pastors came there, and some of their objectives for the retreat were their own personal renewal and to find ways of relating to each other in other than just professional ways. Like instead of talking about how many members did you take in, how many baptized people do you have and all that, that they could find new ways of relating. So I knew if we were to accomplish that, we'd have to get lower our center of gravity, you know, because this is where we are most of the time. So most of us are pretty top heavy. And I thought we want to get a little more balance and get in touch with our feelings, because very hard for these pastors, all white men, to get in touch, I felt, with their feelings. So when it came time for the first moment of spiritual exercise, I had brought with a great big chunk of modeling clay. And I asked them if they would mind each taking a good handful of clay. And I gave it to them. And they, I asked them to go somewhere into a private space of their own and just reflect on the clay. Not consciously to think about anything, but let the clay do their thinking for them. You see, then lower the center of gravity, get them out of their heads. You know, that's, yeah, if that's valuable to have people go out of their heads. But let their hands do the thinking for them and just to work the clay. And so they've all scattered, nobody objected. I always feel kind of manipulative when I do things like that, but nobody objected. And they all said that they hadn't worked with clay since childhood, except one man who had gone to nursery school visitation night with his children, and they had given the fathers a chunk of clay there. But so I heard this pounding and slapping and rolling and all, and then it started to get quiet. They were all off in corners of this large room and some out in the patio area, and they started to let it take shape in their hands. And I had said, when it starts taking shape, you just let the shape speak to you and see what it says about the shape of your life now. After half an hour, I called them back together, and some beautiful things had come out. And I got them into groups of three so they could share what these shapes said to them at this time in their life. And in one group, there were tears. These men were relating because of what one young man was telling them about the pain in his life now, and he had made a little clay model of kind of a ripply lake and a head half submerged, but just the nose peeking out and part of the head out of the clay, and then a great big kind of outsized hand reaching up. And he talked about how he had felt for the past 6 months as though he were drowning. And he was just beginning to get his head above water. And these other two men said, "We never knew you felt that way." And they really ministered. So I think it's very important for us, if we're going to be a community and a ministering, serving community this week, to be willing to kind of risk getting in touch with our feelings, even though it might be kind of painful. And that's kind of a preparation, because in a sense, this is a painful account of the smiling woman. So Margaret Drabble wrote this story, and it's from In the Looking Glass, which was published by G.P. Putnam's Sons, 1977, and edited by Nancy Dean. Margaret Drabble's story, just the beginning of it. There was once this woman. She was in her 30s. She was quite famous in a way. She hadn't really meant to be famous. It had just happened to her without very much effort on her part. Sometimes she thought about it, a little bewildered, and said to herself, "This is me, Jenny Jameson, and everybody knows it's me." Her husband was quite famous too, but only to people who knew what he was doing. He was famous in his own world. He was the editor of a weekly, and so he had quite a pull with certain kinds of people. It was through his pull, really, that Jenny had gotten her job. She was getting bored. The little child was at nursery school and the big ones at big school. So he had looked about for her and asked a few friends and found her a nice little job at a television station. But he hadn't quite bargained for how she would catch on. Everybody had always thought Jenny was pretty. In fact, she'd been a very recognizable type for years, had Jenny. Pretty, a little restless, driven into the odd moment of malice by boredom, loving her children, cooking dinners, flirting a little, or possibly more, with her husband's friends and some old lovers. She deserved a little job. But when she got going, when she got on the screen, she was transformed. She became very quickly beautiful. It took a few weeks while she experimented with hairstyles and clothes and facial expressions. And suddenly she was a beauty. And total strangers talked of her. And that wasn't all either. She was also extremely efficient. Now, she always had been efficient. She'd always been able to get all the courses of a four-course meal onto the table, perfectly cooked at the right moment. She was never late to collect children from school. She never forgot their dinner money or their swimming things. She never ran out of sugar or lavatory paper or sellotape. So people shouldn't have been surprised at the way she settled down to work. She was never late. She never forgot appointments. She never forgot her briefing. She began quietly, interviewing people about cultural events in a spot in an arts program. And she always managed to say the right things to everyone. She never offended and yet never made people dull. She was intelligent and quick. She had sympathy for everyone she talked to, and all the time she looked so splendid, sitting there shining and twinkling. Everyone admired her. Nobody disliked her. In no time at all, she had her own program, and she was able to do whatever she fancied on it. She used to invite the strangest people to be interviewed, and she would chat to them seriously, earnestly, cheerfully. She told everybody that she loved her job, that she was so lucky, that it fitted on so well with the children and her husband, and that she didn't have to be out too much. It's a perfect compromise, she would say, smiling. She didn't take herself very seriously. It's just an entertainment, she would say. I've been lucky, she would say. All I do is have the chats I'd love to have at home, and I get paid to do it. Lovely. Now, her husband did not like this state of affairs at all. He became extremely bad-tempered, never came home if he could avoid it, and yet would never commit himself to being out because he did not want to make Jenny's life any easier, it seemed. He seemed to want to make it as difficult as possible. So he would arrive unexpectedly and depart unexpectedly. Sometimes he brought his friends home unexpectedly, or when they were expected, he didn't bring them home. He made endless unpleasant remarks and innuendos about Jenny's colleagues in the television world, as though he'd forgotten that he had introduced her to them in the first place. He would accuse her of neglecting him and the children. She was not quite sure how this had all happened. It didn't seem to have much to do with her, and yet she supposed it must be her fault. At night, when it was dark, she used to think it was her fault. But in the morning, she would get up and go on smiling. Then one night, she came back from work, as she usually did on Wednesday evenings, late, tired. She noticed as she parked the car outside the house that the downstairs lights were still on, and she was sorry, because she did not feel like talking tonight. She was too tired. She would have quite liked to talk about her program because it had been interesting. She had been talking to a South African banned politician about the problems of political education, but her husband never watched the program these days. She found her key, opened the front door. Her head ached. She was upset, she had to admit it, about South Africa. Sometimes she thought she ought to go and do something about these things that upset her. But what? She pushed open the living room door, and there was her husband lying on the couch. He was listening to a record and reading. She smiled. "Hello," she said. He did not answer. She took off her coat and hung it over the back of a chair. She was going to make herself a milk drink, as she usually did, and go straight to bed. But just for the moment, she was too tired to move. She had had a long day, so she stood there resting, thinking of the walk to the kitchen and how comfortable it would be to get into bed. She was just about to ask her husband if he would like a drink too, though he never did. He didn't like milk, and coffee kept him awake, when a strange thing happened. Her husband put down his book and looked up at her with an expression of real hatred and said, "I suppose you're standing there waiting for me to offer to make you a drink, aren't you?" Now, the truth was that he had hardly ever made her a drink in the evening after work, so she could not possibly have been expecting such a thing. He had done so perhaps 3 times in the last 6 months. The thought of his offering to get up and make her a drink had never crossed her mind. So she answered politely, "No, I was just going to ask you if you would like one." And then an even stranger thing happened. For no sooner were the words out of her mouth than a rage so violent possessed her as though an electric current had been driven through her that she began to shake and scream. She screamed at him for some time, and he lay there morosely watching her, as though satisfied that he had by accident pressed the right button. Then she calmed down and went and made her drink and went to bed. But as she lay down, she felt as though she had had some kind of shock treatment, that she had suffered brain damage and that she would never be the same again. Let's not exaggerate. This was not the first time that this kind of thing had nearly happened to her, but this time it had happened. And the difference between its nearly happening and its happening was enormous. She was a different woman. She went to bed a different woman. In the morning, she woke up as usual at about 7:30 and thought of the day ahead. Every day, she got up regularly at 7:45 and gave the children their breakfast. Various people, including her husband, suggested from time to time that she should engage somebody to help her with these things. But she always said that she preferred to do them herself. She liked to be with the children. She did not like other people to see her at that hour in the morning. Also, she would say, smiling disbelievingly, "I'm afraid I might get lazy. If I give myself half an excuse, I might get lazy and stay in bed." On this particular morning, it did cross her mind that she might stay in bed all day. "I really do not see the point of carrying on," she thought, as she lay there and remembered what had happened to her the night before. "I can't possibly win," she thought. "Whatever I do, I will lose, that is certain. I might as well stay in bed." But no, she thought, "it's more honorable to fight to the death." So she got out of bed, smiling. Were you aware of any feelings as I read the story?
At the beginning, I envied her when she became successful without even trying.
It almost seemed too easy, but it does happen. Anybody else share that feeling of envy? That she was so good, so successful.
I thought you
were. Yes. Because you had something to.
I was wondering what the husband's problem was.
I was wondering what went wrong and how it could have been prevented.
Okay. Wondering what went wrong.
I feel she became her own woman, reborn.
Okay, she became her own woman, reborn.
I felt when she began to have trouble that they should have consulted with someone, a counselor.
Okay. Yes, we don't know how severe the trouble was or the symptoms were before this incident. You know, we're not sure, but it's implied that something was happening, right?
It seemed to me there was a sad loss of communication between husband and wife.
Yes, a loss of communication.
My feelings for her went, like they said, like from awe at the beginning and like, wow, that's really great, to really feeling sorry for her at the end, in especially not just the situation, but just in her own masking it. And just, you know, got out of bed smiling, and how that is sometimes what we do, but kind of I hurt for her, for those feelings and all that inside of her that didn't get out honestly.
I have a little bit of empathy for the fun job and where it can take, where it can go.
I felt rather profound anger for the man. I think he typifies a lot of men who think of their wives as toys or as kind of cutie dolls. He got her something that would satisfy her at home a little bit. Didn't expect that she would become a person in her own right. When that happened, he couldn't handle it. That really did some strong things to me inside.
Maybe not.
I wondered how I received it. This syndrome is at least 80% of the girls I work with. Why we all are facing the same near type situations, a home and family and with continuous struggle. And it comes to either home or family, where most of the girls have chosen to go separately. But in my group, it's just a mirror of the situation.
80% in your group?
At least 80%.
Can
I felt a profound sense of despair as the story went on, because I felt what you're saying, that this is almost the story of every woman, except most of us don't get as far as she did. And I think the reason we don't is that we don't even have the courage to attempt it. Or maybe have a husband who says, "Oh, you need this little token." Little one who says, "Hey, you need to develop your potential too."
She herself said, "I'm lucky." You know, when people said, "How did you do it?" She said, "Well, I guess I'm just lucky."
I felt she didn't know herself.
Yes.
She didn't know who she was.
Okay. She was learning, and it was a painful process, right?
It also struck me how much potential so many women have that do their housework and get the four-course meal on the dinner and don't realize that they could get out there and do some creative things.
Mm-hmm. I think not just maybe an anger at the husband. I was feeling an anger through it also, but not just for the man. I don't know that it's completely their fault. I think it's a whole role type of thing and an upbringing. He was led to believe that this was what his life was to be. It's probably not his fault alone.
I was going to say, I didn't feel sorry for her at all. I felt sorry for both of them in the sense that neither one of them were communicating. I don't see anything to do with her role or his role as being the problem. They could communicate about it.
Okay.
And I felt really frustrated at the end because I thought that at the blow-up, times I thought, it's gonna be dealt with now. It's out in the open, and they're gonna talk about what's going on, and they didn't. And the feeling was, or the assumption is, that life is just going to go on in this kind of controlled anger, situation. Mm-hmm. So I felt real frustrated.
I wondered how the children dealt with all this because they obviously would have been able to feel as it rose and how because. They were in big school, so we were.
Okay. Well, yes?
Kind of had the feeling she won the battle, but she lost the war.
Okay. If there was a war going on, and it certainly seemed like there was in some respects.
It reminded me of this morning's matins. It seemed like everything she did was more like a product and what other people thought of her. That she really didn't have an idea of who she was, and that. She had, I think she kind of wanted to get to that feeling, but she didn't know how to go about it. Mm-hmm. She was a role, she was a housemaker, she was a television celebrity.
Okay.
She was letting them make her, I think.
Okay, it was a continuing thing. Somebody said she didn't know who she was.
I felt just like there might have been a grain of arrogance there, though, too, in that she'd always done the home job so well, and everybody said to her, it's too much, you can't handle all of this, and yet she wouldn't give that side of it up. Well, that side she was probably more comfortable with because she had that a longer time, and she could continue proving that she could handle that. But even at the point of this blow-up, she still didn't want to give that side of it up, and I felt perhaps there was even an exclusion of her husband at that level, that she could have included him at that level while she continued to go on her other, with her other side of her development.
But didn't well, thank you. Part out that he didn't want to be included in that. He absented himself from the home as much as possible. Not every man is willing to take that give and take.
Yes. Definitely.
Especially in our age group.
There are a lot of factors that go in, but in keeping with our general theme of change, obviously their lives were changing. And they were, in a sense, their own lives were a microcosm of the macrocosm of change that's affecting women in our country. Can't speak for the whole world, but women in our country. And some more and some less, depending on your station in life, your situation, married, single, old, young. We're all going through a changing role identity.
change, the one thing you can be sure of in change is that it always brings resistance. Change always brings resistance. Whether it's personal change or cultural change. And so we went through the 60s and the early 70s and the immediate battering down walls that had been put up around women for years and years, and women had put up around themselves. Walls bring a lot of security. And now we're going through a period of really intense resistance to that change and an attempt to put us back before the 60s into whatever it was we were in the 50s and the 40s, or even my mother's generation. Whatever it is, there's always resistance, and the resistance takes many, many forms. But if you can know that, if you can realize that whenever your life changes, if it's a change to another locality, there's resistance. And resistance, change brings then with it loss and grief. And all of you who've read Kiepler Ross's book know that the grief process, the loss process, the death and dying process always brings certain emotions into play. Denial that anything's changed. And so you don't communicate if you're denying that anything's changed. You know, you're going to go on. You're going to still be the efficient housewife and the efficient this, and you're going to be the good mother, and he's going to be the husband who's applauding your doll-like actions and your cute little dollhouse dances and all that. But it's changed. And past the denial stage, then comes the anger. The feelings, and then the depression, and then often the bargaining. You know, I'll do this if you do that. If you stay home, I'll buy you a new car. Or if you let me work, I'll do this. Whatever. Until finally, maybe through some outside help, a consultant or counselor or a friend, people are faced with the need to communicate, to talk about change. And all of these factors are in there. Her guilt, you know, her feeling of guilt when she realized that maybe her husband was right when he said, "You're neglecting me and the children." Her feeling that it was her fault. And so you have behind all that was happening to them in their personal life, centuries of what women were expected to be and what men were expected to be. Men were expected to be the successful people. Their wives weren't supposed to outshine them and be more famous than husbands. And women were supposed to put the home first. And suddenly something else was taking over in her life. She wished she could do something about places like South Africa and all those places that suddenly she was becoming aware of and their needs for justice and somebody to speak to the issues that were beyond her control and seemingly beyond our, but somebody has to do something, and she felt that tug. So, but centuries behind them have condition them to be who they are. And it seems to me that we're at that place in our own personal histories. It's not going to stop. I'm convinced from years of working with women's issues, from the struggle in my life and in our life together, Erling and mine, that it does not stop. It's almost like that movie about the nuclear weaponry, where the technology takes over. The culture and the momentum takes over. The women's movement is not going to stop. it is going to move on, and we can do all we can to resist it, to try to push it back, get it into its neat four walls again, and it is not going to happen. It may temporarily be halted, but it is going to move on, and we are going to see dramatic changes, I believe, in the shape of the family, in the shape of the relationship between the sexes, in our understandings of wholeness for women, so that we can begin to affirm that women who are not married and who do not have children are whole human beings, when for centuries we've been told women are not whole human beings unless they are fulfilled. You know, you're a half human being until you get married, and then you're a whole human being, and then you're only fulfilled when you have children. That is changing, and it's going to change, and it's going to be a profound change for all of us, because as it changes, women are going to say, who am I? Who am I? If I didn't come upon this earth to have babies, as we were told, then who am I, and what does God want me to do? I was brought up, as many of the women here who are of my generation, taught by my mother, and of course by my father, that I would grow up, and if I was lucky, I'd get married. Otherwise, I'd be a frustrated old maid. And that's the way, you know, we talked in those days about those maiden aunts and relatives who had never found a man. And of course I would have children. And thank God for every child I have as a blessing from the Lord. And so my mother had 11 children. 8 of us grew up. And I have 5 children. Yes, I did thank the Lord for them, and I do now, and I enjoyed them very, very much. But I have also enjoyed my life since they left home very, very much, and have never felt that I needed to go on being in the mother role since the last one left 2 years ago to make his own life. And part of that is due to the fact that before that, women often didn't have the 3 things that enabled them to live kind of an autonomous life, 3 factors that were needed. Number 1 was the ability to live a life outside the home in any kind of a successful, achieving way. Because women have only had access to educational facilities pretty much in a general way that is beyond compulsory elementary school education since World War I. When all the boys marched off to war, the universities found themselves without a student body, and so by default, then they decided to take in women. My class was the 2nd class of co-eds to graduate from Luther College, which had been a men's school for 75 years. But in the Depression, because they couldn't make ends meet and they were faced with closing, they decided that they had to take in women. But it was very hard those years, and some of us remember sitting in the boarding club relegated to 2 tables segregated from the men, the girls and the men, and having, I can't eat Royal Anne cherries to this day because they shot the cherry pits at us. But those kinds of changes always bring resistance. And naturally, the boys at Luther College would resist having women bring the changes that were bound to come. And I remember going back for the 5th reunion of my class and having one of my classmates say, I don't know what this school is coming to. Did you see that guy help the girl on with her coat? You know, as though that was such a profound change. Because before that, they had been able to come down to class in their pajamas, and they could no longer do that after girls were admitted to the school. So we resist changes. Then women have, since the turn of the century, we have been told that our life expectancy has gone up. Actually, the life expectancy of men has not increased that much. It's remained pretty stable. But it's the life expectancy of women that has gone up so drastically since the turn of the century. Before that, a man usually outlived one or two wives because women died of the hardships of childbirth and of child rearing. And so then the man would have to take another, usually a younger wife, who would take care of the children of the first wife and then have some children of her own. And this was very common. So we have now a situation where, because of advancement in medical care for women and in household helps that have reduced the hardships of the care of many children, we have women living longer. And the life expectancy of women has gone up tremendously. You know, it's just been 15 years or so ago that there was an article in Time magazine by a doctor who said that there was no point in women living beyond menopause because their reason for living was over. Once their childbearing years were over, why should a woman live? So we've had that kind of thinking. And that's been the result of centuries of being told that this is what we're here for. I have been accused sometimes of using history in a destructive way, and I don't mean to do that. But Gordon Allport, in his book, The Nature of Prejudice, in which he deals with all the things that happen to people who are brought up to believe they're second class, second rate, or inferior, that they begin to internalize that image of themselves. So that if you ask most women, would you like to fly in a DC-10 where a woman was a pilot? Most of them would probably say no, because having been told for years that women are not as smart as men, and women are second-rate creatures, we begin to believe that ourselves. So when we say, do you think a woman could build could have built the Empire State Building? You know, of course not. Men have to do those kinds of things. So the whole business of ability, and then the second thing that we need is permission. You can have the ability to do things, but if society and you yourself and the people around you don't give you permission to use those abilities, you don't have the freedom to achieve either. So what we're seeing now is a period in history when women have the ability and are beginning to believe in their own abilities, just as Jenny did, and are starting to have permission to use their abilities in society. And then the third thing we need is opportunity. And suddenly women are also getting the opportunity. I think it was only about a dozen years or so ago that we were debating whether or not women could be newscasters, because the statement was made women couldn't think sharply enough. They couldn't think on their feet. Their voices were unpleasant. And therefore, they couldn't be professional newscasters on radio and TV. And now it's very common to see women as anchor persons on TV. And in Los Angeles, we have many of them. And they're very popular, and they do a good job. And nobody debates that anymore. But it's taken a while to break down resistance to change for women. And part of that is this centuries behind us, as Gordon Allport says, of conditioning to believe you're second rate. So there becomes kind of a you know, a mass consciousness of inferiority. Some of the statements that have shaped our lives as Christian women are these kinds of statements. Tertullian, one of the church fathers, and you've heard this quoted, some of you, do you not know that you are an Eve? You are the devil's gateway. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man. On account of your desertion, that is, death, even the Son of God had to die. So woman is blamed for the death of Christ. Thomas Aquinas, the father of Catholic theology, current contemporary Catholic theology, says, "Now the father is principle in a more excellent way than the mother, because he is the active principle, while the mother is a passive and material principle. Consequently, strictly speaking, the father is to be loved more." Martin Luther said, "Men have broad shoulders and narrow hips, and accordingly they possess intelligence." That reminds me of what Larry said today about starting out with a theological statement and ending up over here. You know, what does do narrow hips have to do with, and broad shoulders with intelligence? But women have narrow shoulders and broad hips. Women ought to stay at home. Logical conclusion, if you have narrow shoulders and broad hips. The way they were created indicates this, for they have broad hips and a wide fundamental to sit upon. Luther also had another good one. If a woman grows weary and at last dies from childbearing, it matters not. Let her die from bearing, she is there to do it. St. John Chrysostom, who is the golden-mouthed orator, had this golden gem come out of his mouth. "Among all savage beasts, none is found so harmful as woman." Well, this just indicates, you know, centuries of being told that women are responsible for the fall, and that women have been cursed by God. A few years ago, Billy Graham had an article in Ladies Home Journal, which he talked about the role of woman. I don't know if he's changed his mind since, but there he takes the whole cultural position of woman from Genesis, the third chapter, and he focuses on that as God's will for woman, that she is, her desire shall be toward her husband, and he shall rule over her. Nothing about women who aren't married or who are single through death, desertion, or divorce, but simply that this is the role of woman, and no question but that this was a curse that hopefully Christ had power to redeem us from through his death and resurrection. So it would be natural then that someone like Jenny would feel guilty and assume that all of it was her fault. Society still blames women for a lot of the things that are happening. One out of four women stands the chance of being raped or sexually molested before she is 18. And usually, if you've followed some of the court cases, judges will blame it on the way she was dressed, or that she went out alone at night, or often she is made to be, it's the victim who is blamed for the violence against her person. Whereas we don't do the same with burglaries, you know, that it was the person's fault for having a house that didn't have bars on all the windows or had a lock that could be picked. But violence against the person of woman is often taken as being triggered by something she did. So this kind of internalization of a cultural role makes it difficult then to communicate, because the opposite side of that is what you were saying, that men then have been taught they have to be masculine, must be what Aquinas said, the active principle, the aggressor, the achiever, the person who cannot be soft, the pastor who cannot cry, the theologian who must be rational, who cannot be in touch with his emotions. And all of that makes it very difficult then to communicate what we're feeling. How can you admit to feeling threatened if you're a man and you're obviously superior by an inferior person who is a woman? What's wrong with you that you should feel threatened? And so it takes a lifetime of communication and a lifetime of really holding hands and struggling with the basic question. And unless you're willing to do that, and both men and women are willing to deal with these questions, we're going to all stay locked in to our pain and stay locked in to that that despair that we feel sometimes. Will things ever change? And so that we can say like Jenny, no matter what I do, I can't win. You know, I can't win. If I stay home, I can't win because I will deny part of whom I have discovered I am. And if I go out there, I have to deny that other part of me that I am. And so the dilemma is there. And I have talked to, like the 80% you talk about, to the women who live with that kind of despair and don't know whether to go back to the passive role or whether to plunge ahead into that unknown area where they seemingly are in a position of chaos because all the familiar road marks are gone. All the familiar relationships are gone. And out there, you know, it's strange territory for many women. How do you behave in a world you weren't trained to be a part of? If you're aggressive, then you're called a pushy female. If you're not aggressive, then you're told you just don't have what it takes to cut the mustard out in that superior world. What do you do? And so that it's that question that forces a lot of women to go on smiling with heavy hearts and causes their husbands to feel alienated because they can't enter into the struggle. Because if they do, if the husband enters into dialogue with that woman who is changing, he runs the great risk of having to change himself. And that's so threatening. Because if you change, will you no longer be a man? And what will society and what will everybody else think about you? And will your wife even respect you? So we're there. And what do we do about it? What are you doing about it?
Well, I can relate to this really well, not only in my own personal experience, but other people my own age that I know. We kind of went through not exactly this type of situation, but when my husband and I got married, I had been teaching for 2 years already, and he was still going to school, so we were in a position that I was the professional, you know. And he intellectually said, I think, you know, that really the best of all worlds is, you know, people's liberation, that each person should have, fulfill their potential, and you'll all be happier. And that was great. I mean, I wouldn't have married him if he would have said anything else. But when it got into the gutsy, emotional thing, all of a sudden, you have this woman, you know, you'd be proud that, geez, you know, she does really well. But this emotional response, that there was that threat, like Jenny's husband had,
there were, you know, all of a sudden these little threats and feeling insecure and therefore trying to make your wife feel insecure. But one main thing was we did have dialogue and went through talking not only with ourselves but friends but professional people too, as somebody suggested. And in the process it was painful, yes, but today the situation is so much happier. We're both much happier and relieved because one of the things he said, you know, there's so much pressure taken off. You feel so much relief, you know, that active passive thing. He said, I know right now I feel so comfortable that you could handle, you know, that we've become true partners. That it's not just, well, here's this little, I mean, I wasn't about to be anybody's China doll, so he better not expect it. You know, but he was in trouble. But the fact that we worked out that balance, we both feel so much better, and you know, we've got friends that have gone through the same thing, that he feels a lot more secure, a lot more just really relieved and quiet and happy, peaceful, you know, that all the pressure isn't on him. There's somebody there to share that burden. On the other hand, we have neighbors that when you're talking about the father should be loved more, his parents died within a couple years of each other. And his wife told me that he and his twin brother still cannot admit that they love their mother more than the father. You know, and you know, so you've got all of this stuff going on. But you know, I see people that have gone, you know, to the Jenny thing, and let's not talk about it. But the key, I think, is communication, because when you know, when we went through that, and you know, other people will have, it's what, 200% better. You know, and just
that's good.
Deciding that we all have potentials, and if we, you know, there was this whole thing that a happy woman is one whose husband is happy doing what he's doing. Well, I contend a happy husband is one whose wife is doing what she wants to be doing too.
Okay. I hear that you saying that today people are exploring other options than the traditional male-female relationships, and they're able to talk about it before they become married. And hopefully that'll enter into business relationships that might take longer. But there we may have to legislate some things. And that's where we need things, I think, like the Equal Rights Amendment. Because it isn't going to happen just because people of goodwill want it to happen. There's too much resistance to change, and there's too much for men, say, in business to lose by allowing women equal opportunity. There's too much for the state to lose. If the state currently can get more taxes from a woman when her husband dies and she inherits the farm, and they get inheritance taxes from her, but not from the man. And if that has to be equaled out and they can't take inheritance taxes, they stand to lose. So we will need some legislation there. And I wish we had time to talk about all that. Maybe we can find time to continue the discussion. But thank you very much. Keep smiling.